Okay. So a very warm welcome to Christopher Payne, who's joining us from Toronto, where it must actually be very early in the morning. So thanks very much for that, Christopher. And also in the background, we have Daniel Lee from Sinoist Press as well, which is a an added extra. We are here to talk about this fantastic book, Distant Sunflower Fields, which was published earlier this year by Sinoist Press. Daniel said, Daniel's waving it around. It's just had a
I'll
very
do the
nice
same.
review. Yeah, it's just had a very nice review in the Irish Times. It will also be entered for this year's Warwick Prize for Women in Translation, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. Just to introduce Christopher has obviously translated today's book, but also award-winning novels such as Decoded and In the Dark by Mai Jia and Jiang Zilong's, I'm going to apologize for my atrocious pronunciation here, magnum opus Empires of Dust, also published by Sinoist Press, being held up there by Daniel. And that last one was in collaboration with Olivia Milburn. Christopher has a PhD in Chinese literature from SOAS at the University of London. He spent many years whiling away in the rains of Manchester, my hometown. And is now happy to be back in snow, which at least gives some light, something that Manchester is not known for, sunlight. So he's been back at the University of Toronto since last year, which actually, Christopher, must have been quite strange, I imagine, starting that job in the middle of a pandemic. And he continues to champion Chinese literature in the English speaking world. I would just say by way of introduction, and then I'm going to hand over to Christopher. So I didn't really know what to expect with this book, and I was just saying to Christopher and Daniel beforehand that it's not necessarily a book that I would have picked up, I think. I said that it's not the type of book I would have picked up, but actually, I don't know that it's a type of book. I would find it very hard to say, to categorize it. I think it's a very unusual book. So it's set in the northwest of China. It is with it's actually with a group of women, although I didn't particularly think about that. So you're with granny, mum, and granddaughter, living a kind of nomadic life as farmers, trying to cultivate sunflower fields in very kind of harsh conditions on the edge of the Gobi Desert. And there's a kind of traveling crew of animals that accompanies them wherever they go. So there are chickens, ducks, rabbits. There are two dogs, including Shushu, if I'm pronouncing. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that
Taihu.
correctly.
Taihu
Chocho. Somehow, something about this dog's affect had something quite kind of French about it, I think, which is why I thought of Shushu. It's a very it's a dog with a lot of attitude. And then at the very end of the book as well, there's a feral cat who joins the kind of who joins the menagerie.
Menagerie.
Yeah.
Yeah, same word.
And it's an amazing kind of evocation of a place. It is, I think, what I found very refreshing is that it is very much not of the globalized world that we live in. It's very much a place that for me was completely alien. And unknown, and very much kind of it seems very untouched by kind of all the facets of life that we take for granted. Although there is interestingly a mobile phone that pops up in the middle, and I find that very interesting as a kind of turning point. So that's the book in a nutshell. Christopher, I'm just going to start with a quick question, if that's okay. So as I understand it, this author has been publishing in China since 2003, at least.
Yes.
But it's just now that this book and another book have come into English in 2021. So I was wondering why that is, because that's quite a gap, and how you found your way to the book.
Yeah, it's a great start, actually. Insofar as that, I've been studying Chinese literature now since the mid 1990s, so I'm dating myself. So I was the undergrad student who did, Yuhua and Moya and the Nobel Prize winner and Su Tong and all of those movies that were made out of their books and stuff like that. And this was an author that wasn't on the radar whatsoever. Even though, I mean, in the early 2000s, I mean, I was working towards my PhD in the first decade of the 21st century, and still didn't really hear about Li Jun as an author, and didn't really know much about her. And I think that goes back to, there was a review that was written, I think it was some time ago, in the New York Review of Books by either Nick Edmondson or Eric Abrahamson. I can't remember which one it is, which fellow. But he talked about Legion kind of being on the outside of the literary kind of field in contemporary China, partly because she's a younger person, and there is a lot of seniority that goes along with the China Writers Association, and it's also very male-dominated and so on and so forth. Daniel's helpfully put that link up to the New York Times. Thanks, Daniel. And so she's kind of spent the time on the outside and hasn't necessarily been part of it. It's interesting that the two books kind of came out the same year. After kind of learning a little bit more about her, she actually did have a short story that was translated a little while ago that was included in another anthology, but it was all very academic. And so it doesn't get out into the wider readership type of thing. And how I came to her, to be honest, you mentioned it wouldn't have been a book necessarily that you would have picked up yourself. And that was the same for me. So Sinoist, Daniel's there as well. They're the ones who got the rights to the book and then contacted me. I've been working with them, and you mentioned Empires of Dust. And so that was out, and they sent me the copy of this one, the PDF of it, and I read through it, and it was a really kind of engaging book, an intriguing book, and defies expectations. So I was then excited about translating it, and it just happens that, yeah, at the same time, Jack Hargreaves, also a UK-based translator and a co-translator, published her or finished her Winter Pastures as well. And so there's kind of this momentum that's being built up around Li Juan this year. And I think I guess the appeal of it is that it is a unique reading experience. It's a unique kind of lifestyle that she's giving you insight into. You mentioned a very alien world. It is also for me as well. I've been to China many times, but never to the Northwest. And it's still that kind of isolated area in many ways. You hear about it or read about it in history books and so on and so forth, but you don't really kind of grasp what it is. So it was kind of alien to me as well to look at, to read her novel in the first place. And I say novel, it's not really a novel. And it defies easy kind of categorization, because it is based all on fact. It's creative nonfiction, I guess, if there is such a thing as creative nonfiction. And that's what I felt was so interesting about it. And that's what kind of really drew me into it. And to get into translating it, it was an interesting and a learning experience for me to see this part of the world that is very isolated. You mentioned the mobile phones that kind of pop up, but there are all through the airwaves. You probably actually get very good reception in parts of the northwest of China, insofar as all you need is a tower. There's not very much by way of impediments, because it's these rolling lands and stuff. So it was, I guess that's what got me to it, and that's how Distant Sunflower Feeds finally came out. And really happy with it. I guess I give a bit of a personal take here. I got my mom to purchase a copy. Actually, she volunteered, and she's a big reader, but she's a reader primarily of fiction and so on. And didn't really know what to expect, but yes, my son's translation, I'll get it and read it. And she's really, really enjoyed it. And she said it's really different. It's not what I expected at all, is what she told me. And, this evocation of place and the lifestyle out there. And she remarked, it's hard. It's a very rural, rough lifestyle. And to some extent, it's interesting because I originally come from Newfoundland. For those of you who know Canadian geography, it's the island out in the middle of the Atlantic, more or less. It's cold, it's snowy, it's very rural. And even, I remember, I don't think I'm that old yet, but I remember driving down to my grandparents' place, where we had to drive on a dirt road for a good 2.5 hours, then get a ferry ride for another hour and a half to get to this little island that's even further out into the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, my parents grew up there. They grew up in a very rural setting, you know, without indoor plumbing and so on and so forth. So my mom said there was that it kind of evoked those memories for her as well of this very kind of rustic lifestyle and the hard living that they experienced or that she experienced growing up, and obviously Lijuan is as well. And you think, you know, this is the 21st century, right? That it's not a book written about 100 years ago. It's a book written about today. And that's, I guess, what was really striking for her and her reading experience from it. But she's loved it. She thought it was such an interesting take on this particular lifestyle and so on.
So it's passed the mum test.
It's passed the mum test, right? The most important test of all. So, but it was really great. I was very happy. It was, I guess, gratifying to me for her to read it and really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Because I remember, you know, years ago when I was still an undergraduate student and I'd share translations of Chinese literature and say, you know, here, try it out. And she would try it out and like, yeah, no, sorry, this not my cup of tea whatsoever type of thing, right? I think I gave her a copy of Red Sorghum. And you know, no, never again type of thing. But this one she really, really enjoyed. And I guess that's, you know, that the blurb that's in the book about champion Chinese literature in English. I mean, it's people like my mom and stuff that I want them to read, right? I don't want these books to be there, you know, solely for undergraduate students who are studying it as part of their degree, but that we can get it out to a wider readership because there is such great literature that defies expectations, defies genre classifications, that to get these types of works out there, I think that's really key. And I'm really happy that we've done that with Distant Sunflower Fields, for sure.
I think as well, reading this, what strikes me is, I mean, it's immensely readable. You've really created a text that's very readable. I also like the fact that there's talk of granny and mum. It immediately kind of, you have a sense of the family relations. But at the same time, so one of the things that I paused on, and I'm glad that I did, is this word mu. Am I pronouncing this correctly, Christopher? So for the measurement of the fields or the space, the landscape, and it's there and it's in italics. And otherwise, actually, there are very few words in Chinese in the book. But that's one of them. And I think you meet that word very early on. And you have to think about it. It's not immediately clear what it is the first time that you meet it. But I'm really glad that you kept that, because it does give you a sense of, you know, actually this space doesn't function like other spaces that you know. Was that a deliberate decision? Because, I mean, you could have transformed that into something else, I guess, like acres or...
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned that, because we did have discussions about it, about Mu and acre and translating it and kind of, I guess, spatializing the novel itself, because it is very much about the place of the Northwest. Daniel will probably smirk at this because he was in on some of these discussions about Mu and acre and so on and so forth. And it goes back. I mean, I'm a believer to some extent in thick translations. I think, you know, what Appius talks about, these things that have copious footnotes and so on and so forth, and I think there is a place for those. But then on the other end of that argument, I guess, or that kind of debate, is about making it readable. That if you overload what is ostensibly something that should be read for enjoyment with footnotes or endnotes and these types of things, then it becomes almost an academic exercise. And then that can detract, or it certainly make it less attractive to people who are just picking up a book to read. They don't necessarily want to have all of these extra tidbits of information and so on and so forth. So I in everything that I've done so far in translating, it's always trying to strike that balance between keeping certain words and certain vocabulary in pinyin, in the romanized form of the Chinese, to kind of create the feel of difference, that it is about a different place. It is, I mean, It's not about, you know, the northwest of England or the Scottish Highlands or anything like that. But it is, at the same time, I'm a big believer in the kind of pan-human experience, that we experience our lived realities through our I guess, bodily experience of being in the, you know, on this planet. And so there's similarity there. It's interesting because I've just been finishing up my teaching here, and we talked a little bit about cognitive metaphors and the idea that you have these metaphors and how they, I guess, or how they can pose challenges for translators in the sense of how do you translate metaphor, because some of these are really culturally specific allusions and so on and so forth. But if you look at these aspects of pre-linguistic metaphors, that how we conceptualize the world around us, that underscores the importance of the bodily experience, then you see the similarities that are there. So I guess it's walking that tightrope of trying to draw in the average kind of, you know, the person who picks up the book in whatever bookstore, in Waterstones or what have you, and the person who also wants, because I think when you choose to read a translated book, you also want to see something that's different or read something that's different, that maybe kind of pushes you a little bit beyond the boundaries of what you would expect in reading if you were picking up, say, an English novelist. So it's about trying to balance that. I think it needs to be, I want to say the word alienating, but that has too many negative connotations. But in the sense that it does feel different. But then at the same time, you can also kind of see these tendrils of similarity that kind of, you know, walk their way over the landscape, as it were. So that's that balancing act between those types of things. And the mu is, yes, it's an acre essentially, but it's a different measurement of an acre. It's not, I don't even know what an acre measures out to in the metric system. I think they have metric acres. Do they even have metric acres?
I would not be able to answer that.
No, exactly. It was funny because one of a wonderful translator, Nikki Harmon, who I think you've spoken to before, she comes from a rural background as well, and once told me that I was either a father or a grandfather who, you know, told her farming terms and stuff like that. So she would probably know what an acre is, and know exactly how much it works out to. I'm not even sure anymore. And it's the weirdest thing. I've been back in Canada now for a year, so I've had to switch back to metric system. And so I'm trying to get back into that. And I remember living 6 years in Manchester. It was about, you know, your miles and so on. And then I thought that this was something strange. What do you call mileage on a car? And because here it's all in kilometers, and that's mm-hmm. the distance I would use. But you don't have kilometer mileage, or what? It's still mileage. So I don't know. Acre is it is a measurement of something. But I think the moo is yeah. I know it's. It is a space. It is a spatial category, I suppose.
I know that you wanted to talk about place, but I wonder if before we do that, you would read something from the book to kind of give us a sense for, because I think Laura thinks an acre is around half a hectare. Laura, that presumes that you know how big a hectare is.
I was going to say the same thing. I'm not sure how big a hectare is.
So yeah, over but to you, thanks. Christopher. If you would read us something, that would be great.
Sure. Well, I'm going to choose. I chose chapter 19, Mother Earth. I admit it's another aspect of translating. There we've got all these helpful people giving a kilometer by a kilometer. Thanks so much. So I also am doing research, and this was another aspect that attracted me to the book, was the ruminations on the environment, and that's a research concern for myself. I'm very much into eco-criticism, and trying to see how we, you know, how literature and cultural texts can make us think about the environment, and that was another aspect that attracted me to Distant Sunflower Fields, because it's very much, you know, an environmentally based book, and she has these wonderful ruminations. So I've chosen chapter 19. Mother Earth is the title of the chapter. And so I'll start reading, and hopefully you'll enjoy. Excuse me. Lizards, I feel, are the single most similar creature to Mother Earth. Their ability to remain motionless, disguised among the myriad masses of animals populating the planet, serves to make their silence a concentrated single drop of all that is wild and untamed. It's that capacity to conceal themselves in the moment that is the source of the world's brightness, its grandness. At least it is to me. I remember the day, the intensity of the sun at noon was opening up the winter recesses of Mother Earth, burning off the darkness and cold from the night before. I removed my shoes to stand barefoot on the firm, hard earth underneath. I stood there for what seemed like forever. I lingered, but I couldn't hope to match the lizard's ability to do the same. I guess that's what makes us different, Mother Earth and I, estranged strangers. But I remember standing like that, under the light of the world. It felt as though a thousand eyes were staring at me and there was nowhere to hide. All I could do was search for traces of the lizard. Time ceased to pass and I remained there, unconcealed. So many eyes staring at me, and yet somehow, some way, I was able to endure the attention. And in that moment, I found that I could suddenly say all those things I'd been too shy to say before. I could talk of love and attachment. I was no longer plagued by human stubbornness, aloofness. In their place, I felt a sense of kinship with people. I felt clear and honest, pure. And like those people, I felt love for my home, for the day-to-day realities of living, the complexity and the messiness of it all, the contradictions and weight that went with it. But there was absolutely nothing that could make the lizard move. It remained motionless, only 2 or 3 feet away. The sun bore down on it unobstructed. No shadow, no respite. The creature was laid bare in the sun, or perhaps it's better to say it had concealed itself under the sun's glare. There's a particular fierceness about the shape of the lizard's body, but also a certain form of tenderness about it too. Its eyes looked as though they were always filled with tears. I watched it, but it did not watch me. I stared at it, my eyes unwavering, but it never once reciprocated, never once directed its gaze at me. The sun burned white hot. I straightened myself and closed my eyes. When I opened them again, the world had turned the page. There was something different, barely noticeable. The lizard had arched its tail into the air. It was as though it was dreaming. The appendage continued to reach into the sky, although at a speed hardly visible to the naked eye. Ever so slightly, bit by bit, its tail grew longer and reached further and further. I blinked then, a number of times, tried to refocus my line of sight. The reptile's tail had begun to curve ever so slowly around itself, gradually working its way towards its head, seemingly determined to wrap around its tiny torso before finally coming to a halt. Its tail had become an impenetrable barrier protecting its vital regions. Its defense prepared, the lizard now angled its head upwards and trained its ear on whatever sounds it could. Fortunately for me, I remained beyond the range in which it could hear and identify. I was a powerless observer, reduced to using my strength to futilely push against an unbreakable glass barrier. Not only was I prevented from doing more, I was also imprisoned. I thought to scream, but no sooner had the idea popped into my mind that I was forcibly thrust outside this world of living things, beyond the realm of hearing for this little creature. In this arid place, the wilderness marches ever forward, the earth slow and heavy, the sky above light and graceful. And yet, despite its girth, still it moves, always to the future, gradually losing its weightiness to become as lithe and nimble as the air. I feel myself carried up with it, but the blueness is not as welcoming as it seemed. It grows hard and heavy at my approach, imposing its own weight on me. Only the sun remains unchanged, forever above, its gaze forever elsewhere. My mind then suddenly drifts to the inland sea that was once the Gobi. This vast, desolate expanse is the denouement of a great tragedy that played out in this land eons ago. It's the reason why people still say, until the end of days, the world continues to change. When that time comes, when the end draws near, all oaths and promises will fail. I stooped to examine a blade of grass more carefully. Its color seemed dull, its health in question, and yet it was still delicate and fine. I brushed away the sand and dust that clung to it, fully revealing its deep shade of green, exquisite like polished jade. All of this, the end of everything, has always been thus, but no one had ever thought to pay it any attention before. I was the only one who had taken things to heart. the only one who had internalized this pain as though it were my own. The world goes on, marching towards what? I walked on too, on and on, my mind a jumble of thoughts. If I removed my shoes, would my feet grow roots into the earth? If I were naked, would my limbs grow leaves? The more I walked, the more I could feel the earth's heart, its gravitas, its gravity pulling me down. It grew harder and harder to lift my feet from its surface. I struggled against being absorbed into its embrace, from being transformed into a seeds. Seeds in a flower pot can only blindly grope in the dark. Like an old lady's hand clenched tightly to a cane, they searched in all directions without ever seeing anything, carefully extending feelers before retracting them again. Their ears listen, attentive to all sounds. During the day, they hide, concealed deep in the earth, waiting for night to fall so that they can procreate and grow. The seeds buried deep in the earth have no such fear. You call, I shall answer, rise and fall, each struggling to be the first, fearful of losing out. The need for roots to wind and wend their way through the soil, to push and fight for life, a great orchestric concatenation of being. People have come. Their footsteps fall on the earth, and the plants exhale slowly together, urging each other to be silent before they all hold their breath, for the footsteps to pass them before coming to life once again. Only in man's absence can the world feel at ease. Flowers bloom when man is elsewhere. They snatch the moment of time when they're free from human presence. Leaves unfurl when man departs and close just as quickly when he returns. If it's true that nature flourishes only in the depths where single rays of light reach, then humanity's trundle across this earth is the extinguishing of that light. Man's footsteps dig deep into the soil. On those occasions, when Mum strode off into the farthest reaches of the sunflower fields, her shadow was pulled up behind her, long and dark, solitary and lonely. It's as though she were dragging the weight of the world in her wake, the most important people, the most fatigued. At the edges of the world, two healthy and strong, beautiful and vibrant Mongolian gazelles chase each other around, disappearing out of sight over one horizon, only to appear on another. An eagle circles in the sky, a silky wind blows. Granny is here too, pottering somewhat unsteadily over the uneven landscape, a bag in her hand. From time to time, she bends over. I know she's collecting cow patties, therefore the fire to keep her warm. Saihu is here as well, bounding about excitedly, waiting for her chance to race off home, excuse me, with Granny. Saihu, by the way, is the little dog. I knew it was her when she was but a young dog. I knew too that what I was seeing happened many, many years ago. I wondered if this had been the same place Mum had telephoned me from, the land she'd seen out of the storm. The reception had been so good that it was ironic when she couldn't put things into words. She'd looked every which way, but in each direction the far-off sunflower fields withered. Then her eyes fell on a place even further away. A herd of gazelles were trying to evade a pursuing motorcycle. The sky was a brilliant indigo shade. There was no sign of rain. Mum sighed. When are you coming home? Up till now, I've not been able to answer her. There was nowhere for me to escape. I continued to search the area for lizards. The lizards chose not to appear. So I hope you enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the chapter. I kind of love the ruminations on nature and how she's talking about being in this place and the experience of the environment, and then how she juxtaposes that with the trundle of man across this planet and how nature seems to hide in humanity's presence, afraid of the footsteps that dig deep into the earth. And I reading it in the Chinese, I was struck by this personalized experience with it of, you know, her taking off her shoes to feel the earth beneath her. Something we probably don't do enough, you know, we're all don't run around in your bare feet outside. Here in Ontario, in Toronto, we have the other reason, don't run around outside with your shoes off because you might get ticks. And you know, these types of things that are in the grass and you worry about those types of things, but it was this kind of naked evocation of being here on this planet and in this space, that I have these two words that I wanted to talk a little bit about today. That one is Qing, So we've got here, we're talking about seeing with emotions, feelings, a certain sensibility that maybe arises out of it. And the other word was jing, which it's a translator in the dictionary. It's can be place. And it's that kind of these two words, this idea of the emotional response that people have to being out in nature and to feeling themselves in a certain place, that I went back and actually read an early 20th century academic book called Situatedness by an author whose name I forget now. I'm sorry, I'm terrible with names. But it was in this kind of philosophical text, he talks a lot about how people are always kind of working on this idea that the assumption of they have to say where they come from. So I'm from here, I'm from this place. And we even use it like in certainly in academia where we situate our arguments. And this is my point of view, I'm coming from this place. And we're only talking about language here, but there's this constant need to kind of situate ourselves. And if I remember correctly, the book was written like in 2001 or two, or at least that's when it was published. And he talks about all these issues about being in a certain place, of being situated in a certain place. And I linked these up to these two Chinese characters. And I'm working on another paper, so I'm kind of pulling all of these things in together. But you have this idea of qing and jing in the sense of an emotional response to a place that kind of gets you to feel a certain way. And it's linked to this spatial area in which you find yourself in, or whence you come from, as the case might be. And it's this kind of interplay between these two terms of being in an emotional state of mind, which is hard to quantify in terms of concreteness. How do we define certain emotional responses? There's all myriad definitions for emotions. But then we have the place that we are very much, the place becomes evocative of a certain emotion or a certain feel. You know, and we might think of, I guess we could talk about the bourgeoisie longing for a bucolic countryside. That's an invented place then, that we have this kind of creation of the countryside being something that people who live in the city want to get back to or want to return to, that it creates an emotional response in us. And when looking at Li Juan's Distant Sunflower Fields and that chapter, there's other ones too as well, it doesn't come across as this kind of invented space that somebody that's living in an urban environment wants to escape out to, which of course, you know, it belies the discussion of people who have the economic wherewithal to actually do that, to get away for a weekend and go out to the cottage. Here in Toronto, it's the nickname for Toronto is Hogtown, because this is the business center of Canada. But everybody who works in Hogtown in the downtown core, it's like the city of London, they all have cottages in the north of Ontario to go to the lakes and so on and so forth. And you know, reading this particular chapter, Mother Earth, she deconstructs that kind of privileged positioning that somebody living in an urban center might have of going into the countryside, and actually gives you this very kind of, I think at least, this very heartfelt experience of being there. But at the same time, it's also an experience that is potentially threatening, right? She talks about, will the earth kind of drag me down? Will its gravity suck me into it? Will it absorb me? Well, in a certain sense, ultimately it will, right? We all eventually we will all be kind of brought back into it, whether, you know, we are buried or cremated or buried at sea. That's my choice, by the way. But these ideas that there is a return that is inevitable there. So this evocation of emotional response to Mother Earth and the place of it out here in the Northwest, and how, you know, the lizard doesn't bother with her, it's uninterested in her there looking at it, and then it chooses not to appear at the end of it, right? The idea of the flowers and everything only showing their beauty when people are not there. So the whole idea of stop and smell the roses, well, the roses don't care if you do or not. They'll probably close up. These are some of the things that have been kind of working through my mind. And that was part of the reason that I was so attracted to this creative nonfiction, because it's not a novel in the sense that there's, you know, it doesn't have the three unities. It's not Aristotelian. It doesn't go from beginning, middle to end. One of the comments I've had actually from my mom who read it was that it's great because you can kind of pick it up and read chapters at different times, and you are immersed each time you read a different chapter, that it very much puts you in the place. So I guess, yeah, that's part of these thoughts and ideas that have been running around in my head with regard to the novel. And that was particularly why I wanted to read that passage, because I think cultural texts have important things to say about our relationship with the natural environment and what we or how we experience it and so on. And I think it deconstructs on many different levels, not only in that chapter but in other chapters, the anthropocentrism of so much writing and talking about the environment, that it's there for us to absorb or us to spectate on, but nature itself isn't bothered with it, right? The lizard doesn't care. The flowers will actually hide away from people. And so it depositions, I suppose, the human side of this qing and jing, of the emotional response that we have to a place. I hope that makes kind of sense, because I will admit these are still thoughts and ideas that are running around in my head. And as I try to, you know, kind of create a vocabulary that I can speak about it, but it certainly comes across in Distant Sunflower Fields. So it was a very, on a certain level, it's a very intimate translating experience. Not that I got to know Li Juan. We actually only met after the book was translated. But her words are very much there in the book itself. And immersive experience. I guess it's, you know, virtual reality. That's the vocabulary we use today. This is an immersive experience. Or at least that was my feeling when I had translating it and then reading it and so on.
There's a wonderful little sketch that she gives of I think she's taking a bus with a man who's coming from the town or the city into this area. And he's freaking out more and more as he gets further and further away from quote unquote civilization. And he can't stop rabbiting on, you know, and saying like, well, where are the people and where's this and where? And that it's just a snapshot, but it's really.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And he does freak out very much so. And I think there is that even like, say, if you go out to go to your cottage or go camping or whatnot, it's still, you go to a camping site. You go to something that is human constructed. That, you know, you don't, I actually did when I was younger growing up in Newfoundland. We still had the opportunity to go out and just go into the woods. And now you need permits and everything, right, for basically everything. But I've done sandpit gravel camping, where, you know, you just find a pit and you put up your tent and so on. And I've been out in the woods, you know, where we had to worry about black bears and these types of things, because, you know, they were out in the woods with us. We weren't in some designated camping spot. And you know, that's, I, this came up actually in another discussion we had with another book that I've just translated by Jia Pinghua, about trying to get the rural sense of voice that's there. And I think I tried to draw upon my own experience of growing up in very rural Newfoundland. And it's, of course, it's more sea orientated, I suppose, because it's a fishing community. But we did go off into the woods. Newfoundland is a huge island, and it has about 550,000 people. Right, to go from my city to the provincial capital was 8 hours drive. So you can imagine how big it is, and how few people are there in it. So lots of open spaces, lots of, well, not open, but a lot of forested spaces. So I tried to draw upon that kind of emotional experience of my own that I had when working on Distant Sunflower Fields and on this other one by Xia Pinghua, to try and give that ruralness something hopefully that comes across as a little bit more real in the experience of it. And I remember looking, we didn't have lizards in Newfoundland, but I remember looking for animals out in the woods and stuff like that and how disinterested they were in us. And, you know, except for the bears, of course, when you had, they would be attracted by the food. And if anybody ever is out camping with bears, never run away, right? That's the worst thing to do. You run, the bear thinks of you as prey and it will run you down. Make as much noise as possible and try and frighten it off.
This is a first for Warwick Thursdays. It's a Canadian public service announcement, everybody. If you find yourself in the woods with a bear, you've just heard it from the expert. I think one of the reasons why I noticed the man on the bus is because I suspect, I mean, hopefully I wouldn't babble that much, but I can see that if you have grown up in an urban environment, it would blow your mind, I think, to be in a space like that. I mean, she talks about how she goes walking for hours and hours on a day when there's not particularly much to do, and you really have the sense that essentially you can pick your direction, right? There's no, there are no paths, are no way markers. you just go, and those spaces really, I mean, certainly in Europe, they don't exist really.
No, not anymore, right? I mean, you can go up to the Lake District, you can go to the Peak District. We did many, many times, but you know, you followed paths. Even when you walked around, you followed paths, and there were markers, and the, you know, the inevitable little town that's there, with a, you know, hopefully a pub, these types of things. But it is different, and that's, I think, something that really attracted me to distant sunflower fields was that, as you say, you can just kind of set your own direction and just go. And I mean, her mom and her motorcycle is great for that, because in one part she builds her own little path with the motorcycle to get back and forth to the water area to get, you know, to bring water every morning. And she makes her own little road, right? And this is my little path, and this is, you know, for me, and I'm using it. And being able to kind of, I guess, experience life in that way is very unique. And that, I think that's what makes this novel or this work hard to categorize it again. But it's, I think that's what draws, at least drew me in, and hopefully it will draw other people in. That type of emotional experience, this emotional experience of place, is very much this qing and jing. These two particular words that I think are very much at play here in Distant Sunflower, for sure.
We're going to move to questions in a minute. I'll just give people a minute or two to get their thoughts together. But if you have questions and you'd like to either switch your camera on and ask Christopher, we also have Daniel, the publisher, here as well. Or if you'd like to pop them in the chat, that's also fine. I suppose the last thing I wanted to ask Christopher, or maybe just remark upon, was the fact that, I mean, in many ways, this is a kind of pre-modern world. I mean, yes, there's a motorcycle.
Mobile phone.
yeah, and the phone is a weird kind of thing that sort of pops up in the middle. So not sounds to be not very reliable, because the signal is not always good. So clearly they walk around trying to catch the signal. But it's a funny, it kind of occupies this strange position for her, because she takes her photographs on it and she has her music on it, and it's like a companion, really. Actually, it's not really there for phoning. It's a kind of repository of memories or impressions or
I was just going to say, Daniel and them at Sinoist were really great in that they reproduced the images at the end of the book, and you know, a lot of publishers don't do this, so hats off to Sinoist and Daniel and them for doing it. But these are pictures that she took with the phone. So it's really neat to actually have that in the translated version as well. So there's pictures of them. They describe their home, or at least one of them that they had, because they do lead a nomadic existence. But they, you can see a picture of it. It's a hole in the ground, basically. You can't, I'm not sure you can see it. You can see it there, and then you can get pictures of the people. That's one of the little dogs right there. You can see that's Saihu, the little white dog there at the back. I think you can see it more clearly. And so on. So you get, you know, it's wonderful that you have it, and you think of the phone there as that companion, right? So you can take nothing but sand, and then on the next stitch you have this beautiful flower that grows there. which, you know, it's gorgeous. So it's, yeah, the phone is probably like companion more so than for trying to get phone calls or make phone calls for sure.
Can we open for questions? Anyone who would like to jump in and ask Christopher a question, or maybe Daniel?
Well, I have a question, if you don't mind, Christopher.
Okay. Please go ahead.
I mean, obviously now we've hosted quite a few events now with B2N, and we've had the chance to speak to her and stuff like that. And she's very, at least publicly, she's very kind of a little bit, I say the best word probably is shy and very kind of reserved person. I mean, obviously, like she is like who, if she is not who she is, she wouldn't be able to come up with works like this, right? But the thing is that obviously you're very much attached to the work itself. When you were going through the work itself, did the personality come through, that shyness come through, or is she much more expressive with her words, do you think?
That's a it's a good question. Having translated the book before meeting her, I wouldn't necessarily think of her as being shy. But then after meeting her and kind of seeing that, it does come through in the work much more. That there a lot of this there's the wonderful descriptions of the life that's out there, but there is a lot of this is internal. So it's interesting because it's, I guess, shy in the sense of public speaking, but not in the sense of putting all of these things down on the page. And that becomes the interiority of her work is certainly visible. But yeah, before actually meeting her, I don't know, it's hard to say now, because I think that experience of actually meeting her and talking to her and having that insight into it kind of does imprint on the translation. In the initial sense, I probably would not have guessed. But then at the same time, I think maybe I would have if I don't know. It's a non-answer, I guess, in the sense I'm not sure how to answer that, because it's a very personal work, and it's very insightful in that way. And how I guess a writer comes off and presents that in, say, video sessions or in public speaking events is or can be very different, as to what they reveal, in, you know, on the page itself.
Do you have a sense of what kind of life she leads? I mean, is now that she's more published, is she a full-time writer, or does she do other things?
She has more or less been a full-time writer, and kind of eking out an existence, I suppose, in this area. I think she's still very connected to the area and does still spend time out there. We met actually the first time she was in Hainan Island, which is probably as far away from the northwest as you can be in China. It's a kind of the subtropical island that's really nice and pretty and warm and very well developed now. But I think she's very much connected to that place, of the northwest, of being there, and that visceral feeling of living that kind of experience, of living that kind of life. I think that's very much there still for her. And she's still, I mean, her relationship with the China Writers Association, she mentioned this in the video event that we had a little while back, and talks about it, how there were some, you know, she's not considered the darling of it at all. She's not considered to be like, yes, we want you, we want to promote you and do as much as we can for you. But there are people who are really appreciative of her work and do what they can, I suppose, to ensure her the literary space to get these things out. But she's not held up as somebody that they promote either. So I think she's still removed from that as well.
She's very much
Yeah.
a writer's writer, I would say. Like you speak to Chinese writers. I mean, generally speaking, these things, you have the official authors who the kind of establishment promotes, right? But then you have these private conversations with writers, and you bring up Li Jian, and they're like, oh, they've had nothing but positive things to say about her. Normally, generally, it's a bit of like, you speak to an author, they do a bit of bickering and stuff like that, kind of like a sly word here and there. But Li Jian's very much not a bad word about her at all in authors.
Do we have any questions from the audience? Anybody wants to jump in?
Just in case anyone's curious about like kind of Li Jian's speaking style, I've put a link in the chat where you can get a kind of idea of like this is for one of the previous events we did with her, and she gives a bit more in depth of an idea of how her like kind of writing and where she's coming from, sort of thing.
Daniel, while we have you here, I know that we have talked already, but people in the audience will be new to this. Would you tell us something about Sinuous Press, which is fairly new, and kind of what your mission is? What are you all about?
Ooh, that's a big question. really?
He's rolled it up. He won't stop.
We're a small indie pub based in kind of south of England, kind of halfway between London and Brighton in a town called Horsham. And our goal very much is to kind of bring out the best of Chinese literature to an English-speaking audience. I mean, it's one-fifth of the world, right, at the end of the day. And people there must read something interesting. That's at least the business model. And our goal very much to find the kind of the best and then bring them out. I mean, the majority of our works, in one way or another, are kind of prize-winning in their original in their original homeland. So, for example, *This and Sunflower Field* won, I believe, the Lucian Award, which is essentially, I would say, probably an equivalent of a nonfiction Booker in China. And a lot of our other more fiction works are won things like the Maoduan and the Lao Shi Awards, which are very much these top tier awards in China. But once you get out of China, obviously they don't have any currency. Our goal very much is to make people understand why these works are appreciated in their homelands, and like what's so special about them, what unique things they have to tell, really. And to give you an idea of who we are an off branch of another company called ACA Publishing, Allen Charles Asia. And essentially, we've been around for one form or another since the late kind of, I'll say late 80s. We were one of the first kind of Western publishers that was allowed to set up an office in China way back in when the reforms first happened. And we were originally B2B magazine publishers. So these are things like, for example, Metal Prices in Guangzhou province today, sort of thing. But with kind of change and with it's very much over the last kind of 30 years or so, especially in the last 10 years, we've very much morphed ourselves into a more book-oriented publisher, kind of translating the best of nonfiction coming out of academic texts originally coming out of China. And Sino's Books very much is an initiative that started in the last 5 years or so, where we looked around at the market and thought, what is it that unique that we can bring to the market that isn't here currently, and very much fiction. Like, when was the last time that you picked up a Chinese fiction book, you know, to a general English speaking audience? Whereas, like, for example, a lot of the other East Asian literatures, for example, Korean or Japanese, they're getting the time in the sun right now. So very much the mission of the last 5 years is kind of discover what worked with the other East Asian literatures and kind of bring that model into Chinese and bring out these authors from I really lost the thread there, didn't I?
No, that's great.
I would jump in and say what I mean from my experience working with Daniel and them with Sinuist is that the options and the writers that they've been engaging with are not the kind of already well-established authors who get their books translated kind of even before they're written. Certainly in North America, it's Howard Goldblatt who has this kind of thumbprint on the translation of Chinese literature. But I mean, if you look back at it, a lot of those examples, they were published by university presses. They were very much geared towards an undergraduate reading community. There was efforts at different times. I think Penguin has published in the 90s, you had Wang Shuo and his Hooligan Literature, I think, came out with Penguin. And there were a couple other options, but it's been these certain writers like Yu Hua and Mo Yan and Su Tong, and these were the big names and have remained the big names and stuff, and their stuff is always translated. And I think what's great about Sinoist is that it's bringing out a diversity of voices. It's showing that these are not the only authors that are working. They're not the only ones that win the awards in China, that there are these myriad voices that have, you know, great things to present to us and give us insight into this huge literary domain of works being published in the Chinese language. And I think that's what's been great about working with Sinoist.
It's like the books coming out over the last, I would say, 30 years, ever since the reform started, very much it's like it's one of the great frustrations for me personally is that Chinese literature gets pigeonholed into, it either has to be like, pardon my, the language might not be suitable, it either has to be poverty porn or dissident, right? There can't be anything other than that coming out of China. And it's, and I think personally for myself, I think that leaves a lot of good stuff on the table that just doesn't get displayed all that much. And it's about like saying like, China is more than those two things, really. And it's more than what you read about it on the news. There's infinite complexity to the situations on the ground. And hopefully through our work, we can display a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm. We're almost at the end, which was 60 minutes that flew by there. maybe I can finish, Christopher, by asking you something that you can never ask creative writers, because if you ask them what they're working on at the moment, they get very cagey and don't want to talk about it, like they're going to jinx everything. But are you working on a new translation at the moment, or do you have something that you, where you'd like to go next?
I do, actually, another book with Sinoists. Well, Daniel showed one that is coming out next month, The Mountain Whisperer by Xiaoping Hua. That's his shameless promotion there. But it was a great experience working on this book by Xiaoping Hua, who is an incredibly unique author from Xi'an, so from the ancient Qin dynasty capital, who, you know, whether you think of terracotta warriors and all of those things that are in kind of popular media. He has a distinct flavor to his work. So that's the book that Daniel was just showing is coming out next month, I believe, Daniel. Is that right?
Yeah.
This month.
Yeah, it's a beautiful hardback. Beautiful.
Yeah, they've done a wonderful job with it. Shameless promotion. Shameless. But in any case, that's one. And so I've actually begun work on a second Xiaoping Hua book. So I'm also going to be working, I have started this month, actually, with my teaching concluded here in Toronto, that I've started on his Gulu, which is Old Kiln, which is a large book. it's going to take me much of the next year, if hopefully not more than that, but certainly it's a big book that, again, I mean, all of Jia's works are based in the same area, in his hometown or around his hometown area, and kind of provide this really intimate picture of that area and the life that's there. So I guess I gravitate towards certain things as well, maybe, in terms of what translations I end up doing. But I'm very much enjoying starting this. It's unique. Jia has his own flavor in terms of his vocabulary. It's very local based. It can also be quite, I want to say raunchy, vulgar maybe in places. He's very, which actually is kind of fun because I love to swear myself. So I think swearing is great. Being able to put that into literature is wonderful as well. But it's that kind of, I don't want to say salt of the earth type of thing, but that feel to it And the historical period, it touches on the Cultural Revolution and so on. So it has linkages to the much larger history that was happening in the mid-60s and 70s in China, but then also the experience of that larger history in a very kind of miniature scale, because it's very much about that one particular area. And he touches on that in Mountain Whisperer as well. So that's what I'm working on now. So hopefully Mountain Whisperer out in a couple of weeks, and then hopefully another Jia Pinghua book in next year sometime. We'll see how my progress goes. It's a big book. It's larger size than, and it's 600 plus pages. So that one, yeah, you can see the difference. And if you look at the size of Mountain Whisperer, Gulu is bigger than that one. So
I'll say probably
it's a big project.
We're looking at like Empires of Dust size, definitely.
But I actually really like those big novels. As much as I like Distant Sunflower Fields, and that you can kind of, you know, engage with it on a very kind of relaxed way, I suppose you could say, where you could pick it up and put it down and pick it up and put it down. I also like those really big meaty novels as well that kind of draw you in and you have a sense of, feel a sense of accomplishment when you've completed them.
We had a reviewer that said about Empires of Dust, it's like, it's nice to get the time to get to know everybody. I think that's
yeah, so what's not to like about a big novel, eh?
Exactly.
Well, I always think are they like Charles Dickens and they get paid by the word? I mean, is that what it is? And that's why Dickens novels got progressively bigger and bigger. But hey, who likes? I mean, everybody likes Dickens. That's also enjoyable to read.
That's true. We'll bring things to a close. Thanks everybody for attending today. I can only really, and I'm not in the employ of Sinuist Press. I'm just going to plug this because I read it and I really loved it. It was a great surprise and a real pleasure. So if you have some time now or later when exams are done and essays are written, do think about getting yourself a copy. Christopher, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much for making the time so early in the morning. Daniel, thank you also, and we wish Sinuist Press the very best of look, I can only say that if this is the quality of the books that's coming out, then I look forward to reading more. And I hope that the press does really well. And thanks everybody for joining us. I don't actually know if we have a speaker lined up for next week, but I'm sure if we do, then an email will be going out soon.
I'll just add, if anybody does have questions, you can find me at University of Toronto. So my, you know, public email address is there. Would be happy to talk more about Chinese literature should anybody have questions and stuff. So very happy.
Can I make one shameless plug? We have an event coming up in association with the Sotheby's Institute of Art about another one of our authors, Feng Jitai. He's a kind of classically trained artist that used to be an animator, but now is kind of one of those big figures in Chinese lit. And it's on the 25th of June, I believe. So we'll definitely send out to our socials if that's something that interests you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks, everyone. I'm gonna.